From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On today's edition of Fresh Air, we meet the man who discovered Marlon Brando and James Dean and directed them in now classic films. Director Ilya Kazan has written a new autobiography. Also today, I speak with author John Rothschild. Even though he knew nothing about Wall Street, Rothschild decided to invest his money in the stock market and write about the experience. You get an idea of how things turned out from his book's title, A Fool and His Money. And we have reviews of singer-songwriter Tracy Chapman's debut album and Babette's Feast, this year's Academy Award winner for Best Foreign Film. That's all coming up on today's Fresh Air. When would-be actors and neighborhood hams do their imitations of Brando, they're doing scenes from movies directed by my guest Ilya Kazan. Kazan directed Brando in A Streetcar Named Desire and On the Waterfront. He also directed the films East of Eden, Splendor in the Grass, Baby Doll, A Face in the Crowd, and The Last Tycoon. Kazan has had an equally important career in the theater. In the 1930s, he worked with the Group Theater, where he followed the vision of Lee Strasberg and learned the style of acting that became known as the Method. He later co-founded the Actors Studio with Strasberg. Many of Kazan's friends and colleagues never forgave him for naming names when he was called before the House Un-American Activities Committee during its relentless search for communists. For many years, Kazan refused to publicly address the subject, but he breaks the silence in his new autobiography, Ilya Kazan, A Life. Before we meet Kazan, here's your opportunity to play Dueling Brandos.
Hey, shut up!
You put that howling down there and go to bed.
Yes, I want my girls out here.
You shut up! You're going to get the law on
hey,
you.
Hey, shut up!
You can't see that woman and then call her back because she ain't going to come. You're going to have a baby.
Listen, you're
I hope they haul you in and turn a file.
Yes, I want my girls out here.
You stinker!
Hey, Stella! Hey, Stella!
I wouldn't mix in this.
Ilya Kazan, welcome to Fresh Air. John Ford advised you when you switched from theater to movies to direct films as if they were silent films, to really use pictures to tell the story. Yet, you have directed some of the most memorable scenes of dialogue in film history, and I find that a kind of interesting irony.
That's true. It's just my background, Terry. I mean, I do come from the theater, and I have always directed dialogue scenes, and Jack came out of movies. He directed two reelers and westerns and so on, and it was natural for him to say what he did, but it was a lesson to me, and I try to make a film that would be clear and stand on its own despite not having the dialogue, without the dialogue, put it that way. And I used to watch Jack shoot and talk to him sometimes on weekends, and I got a lot out of him, how swift you can be, and that the audience doesn't need to know quite as much as it had to know in the theater.
I want to talk with you specifically about some of the movies you've directed and some of the scenes within those films. Let's start with A Streetcar Named Desire. Now, you actually really discovered Marlon Brando for the stage version of that, which you directed before directing the film. Why did you want him to audition for the role in the stage version?
Well, there was no audition. I had produced a play with Harold Klerman where he played a part, and he played it like a 5-6 minute scene, and he was stupendous and he was marvelous in it. And that was his audition. He didn't know it. But then when we lost John Garfield and I began to think who really would be good as Stanley Kowalski, I thought of Marlon and gave him $20 to go up and see Tennessee Williams up at the Cape. I learned later he hadn't showed up, but he'd hitchhiked and used the $20 to eat with. So, but anyway, Williams took to him immediately. He called me up. He was ecstatic. He was overwhelmed, and that's all the audition there was.
When I think of all the actors and all the people in general who have imitated Brando doing Stella, untold numbers of people, what went on when you were directing him in that scene?
In that scene?
Yeah.
I just told him to get on his knees at the bottom of the staircase, but I didn't tell him what to do with his voice or how he should shout it. He just knew. Many things with him, many times with him, he was ahead of me. That is, he understood what I said and understood it better than I said it. And I hardly had to tell him anything once I said, "You fall on your knees." And he did. And that's all there was to it.
How many takes did you do of that scene?
How many takes did I do? I think two.
And you knew you had it?
Yeah. Well, you couldn't mistake it, could you, really? That tone of voice. I mean, people have imitated it and shouted it and it's been on comedy shows and everything. It's just once in a decade a voice like that comes out.
Now, you directed Brando again 3 years later in On the Waterfront. I found out in your book that it was initially supposed to be Frank Sinatra in the role.
Yeah, he would have been damn good, too, but not as good as Brando. I don't think anybody's as good as Brando, but Frank would have been very good. Frank comes from Hoboken, and he's a street kid, too, and he's tough, and he would have been good, and he's tough the way Brando's tough. He's got a tough exterior and knows what to do with his fists and so on, but he also has a very poetic and romantic side that comes out in his songs, of course. Anyway, I was ready to do it with Frank, but one thing led to another in the contracting, and also in Frank's schedule. He had to be somewhere at a certain time. I've forgotten the details of it, and we switched to Brando.
Brando in that movie really has this combination of strength and vulnerability.
Right, Terry, you hit it.
What did you talk with him about when he took on the role? About what characteristics you wanted him to get in there?
Just that. I said he keeps a tough front towards everybody, but he feels his guilt about Eva Marie Saint's brother terribly, that it kills him. He can't get rid of it. And he really would like to be out of the gangster hoodlum world and didn't like what they did to him because they humiliate him. The part Lee Cobb played constantly humiliated him, made him appear like a cheap kid, and I told him that he would resent that and not show it for a while, and then release it as the film went on.
I want to play another one of the most famous scenes in movie history. And this is the I Could Have Been a Contender scene. Now, in your book, you're very self-effacing about it. You say that you've been highly praised for the direction of the scene, but the truth is you didn't really direct it. It kind of directed itself. I don't truly believe that, so let's hear the scene, and then we'll talk about it.
I'll show you one thing about it for you, dude.
Okay.
The scene is good for several reasons, but one reason is because it was beautifully written by Bud Schulberg. It's a perfectly written scene, and in a kind of a tough language that is poetic in itself, that's all.
And the scene is played by Marlon Brando and Rod Steiger.
Right.
That skunk we got you for the manager, he brought you along too fast.
It wasn't him, Charlie, it was you. You remember that night in the garden, you came down my dressing room and said, "Kid, this ain't your night. We're going for the price on Wilson." You remember that? This ain't your night. My night, I could have taken Wilson apart. So what happens? He gets the title shot outdoors in a ballpark, and what do I get? A one-way ticket to Palookaville. You was my brother, Charlie. You should have looked out for me a little bit. You should have taken care of me just a little bit so I wouldn't have to take them dives for the short end money.
Well, I had some bets down for you. You saw some money.
You don't understand. I could have had class. I could have been a contender. I could have been somebody instead of a bum, which is what I am. Let's face it. It was you, Charlie.
There's a musicality in the way those two actors read their lines that is really something. Did you work with them on that?
No. I didn't direct that scene much. I didn't direct that scene, really. By that time in the shooting schedule, both Rod and Marlon knew what they had. And then the lines themselves are so beautifully written. Instead of a bum, which is what I am, that's the way those people talk. They're perfectly written lines, and Marlon naturally took to them.
You know, it's great. It's your classic talking head scene. It's two guys in a cab. In the rear view window, there's actually Venetian blinds, so you can't even see the traffic coming through.
There isn't any.
Yeah, so it's just two guys talking.
If we had traffic, Terry, it would have been a distraction, wouldn't it? Don't you think so?
Yeah, no, I think you're right, because you're just totally focused on their faces and on what they're saying.
Right.
You have really taken pride in directing actors who are encouraged to ask questions about what they're doing.
Yes.
What kind of questions did Brando ask you about this role? Any questions?
Very, very little. I think we had an instinctive fraternity. I think we understood each other almost from the word go very well. And we would talk a lot about other things, but not a hell of a lot about the role. This role is written thoroughly. When he says taking dives, Palookaville, all that, and it's written very thoroughly and beautifully. And he didn't need much instruction. I mean, I wasn't kidding in the book. I wasn't being falsely modest. I think I'm a damn good director and have been a damn good director. But in this scene, I didn't direct that scene much. Very little. I just put them there and so on.
A lot of the extras in On the Waterfront were actually longshoremen.
Right, and hoodlums.
And hoodlums, yeah. So you had a bodyguard in the making of the movie?
I had a bodyguard 6 feet behind me at all times. Well, there were some rough characters all around me, and they were taking offense that we showed... We showed Hoboken, for example, for a bad place, and they were offended. I laugh at that. But anyway, they had civic pride. That's what made me laugh. I thought they had civic pride, and nobody threatened me much. Once a fella came and slammed me against the wall and was going to beat me up, but then the bodyguard and another friend named Brownie came up, and that was the end of that threat.
Gosh. Ilya Kazan is my guest, director of film and theater. He's also a novelist and has written a new autobiography, which is titled Ilya Kazan, A Life. Let's move on to another movie you directed. Now, we talked about how you really basically discovered Marlon Brando. You also really discovered James Dean. You gave him his first film role in your film East of Eden.
Yeah.
I find that kind of interesting in a way because they were both at the time young actors with this pent-up energy and alienation?
Yeah, that's it. Alienation is right. Pent-up energy is right. Terry, you've got it exactly right. Not especially. Both of them, the same way. Same thing in both of them. Somehow that must have appealed to me because maybe I have pent-up energy and alienation, too. I feel brotherly towards them.
Would you describe the meeting with James Dean that made you realize he had something?
I went to see a play of his, and a friend of mine named Paul Osborne had recommended him to me. And I went to see him in a play. He played a part of an Arab, a small part, and I didn't think much of him, but I thought just to please Paul, I'd ask him to come into Warner Brothers office. And I went in there that day, and there he was, like I say in the book, like a pile of rags in a corner, all bent over, scrunched up, and so on. I thought, well, he didn't even get up, didn't look at me, didn't get up. And so I went in the office and thought, well, I'll make the son of a bitch wait a little bit, it'll do him good. So anyway, finally I called him into the office and he came in and he didn't say anything. He was not a talker. So finally he didn't say a damn thing. And I said, well, and he said, you want to go for a ride with me on my motorbike? So I said, God, I hate motorbikes. I didn't say it to him, but I do hate motorbikes. I think they're a menace. And I said, all right, Jimmy, well, let's go. So I went downstairs, and he got his motorbike and unlatched it or unchained it or whatever he did. And I got in the back, and he rode me around the middle of the city. And it was like he was showing that a country boy can defy the city and defy the rules of the city. He zigzagged in and out. I didn't want to ruin my relationship as a director by saying, Jimmy, I'm frightened, cut it out. I was frightened. But anyway, we finally both lived.
I want to play a scene from this movie. And this is a scene where, well, let me, for our listeners who haven't seen the movie in a long time, in East of Eden, there's a father played by Raymond Massey, and he has two sons. One son he favors. The son he doesn't favor is James Dean. And James Dean has worked really, really, really hard to endear himself to his father. He's invested money in bean futures in the hopes of making back money that his father lost. And it's his father's birthday. He's presenting him the money, but his father won't accept it. Here's that scene with Raymond Massey and James Dean.
As for you, it's all the money you lost in the lettuce business. That's for you, and I made it for you.
Cal, you will have to give it back.
No, I made it for you, Dad. I want you to have it.
You'll have to give it back.
Who? I can't give it.
To the people you got it from.
No, British Purchasing Agency? I can't give it back to them.
Then give it to the farmers you robbed.
We didn't rob anybody, Dad. We paid 2 cents a pound, 2 cents over market for that stuff.
Cal, I signed my name. And boys go out, and some die. and some live helpless without arms and legs. Not one will come back untorn. Do you think I could take a profit from that? I don't want the money, Cal. I couldn't take it. I thank you for the thought, but...
I'll keep it for you. I'll wrap it up, and we'll just keep it in here.
I'll never take it.
There's a great part right after that where you can't tell whether James Dean is going to hug or slug his father.
That is good, yeah.
Now, you write in your book that there really was a tension between James Dean and Raymond Massey. And
yes,
you basically tried to exploit that in the movie.
They didn't like each other. And especially Ray Massey couldn't stand Dean. He just hated to play scenes with him. And I didn't, I guess I did exploit it because I didn't do anything about curing it or easing it. And you see how much he resents him in the scene, in the role, but also he did in life. And it served my purposes to not do anything about it. I didn't egg them on to each other, but I didn't do anything to keel it.
If James Dean had more technique as an actor, if he had been more experienced, would it have been unnecessary to play up that antagonism in real life between Dean and Massey?
It wouldn't have hurt, Terry. The truth is, it wouldn't have hurt. Everybody's so chummy. On a stage set, you know, everybody gets coffee and gets flattered and everything else, and very soon they lose the sense of what they, a very driving emotion underneath the scene. They become comfortable. Comfortable is not good when an actor gets too, and stays away from everybody and stays, you know, just is flattered and has his girlfriend there too. God knows what goes on. You know, it's better to irritate them a little bit so they're on edge. I mean, it's very serious business, emotional film.
Yeah. My guest is Ilya Kazan. He's one of the leading theater and film directors of our time. His movies include On the Waterfront, Streetcar Named Desire, Splendor in the Grass, Baby Doll, and A Face in the Crowd. He's written a new autobiography titled A Life. We'll talk more about his work after this short break. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
Ilya Kazan is my guest. You know, in the clips that we just heard, we heard from Brando and from Dean, two very different actors in that Brando you describe as an actor with a lot of technique, Dean as an actor who had virtually none, at least at the time you directed him. How does that change you as a director, depending on whether you're working with someone who has a lot of technique or someone who's more of a natural and doesn't have that technique?
You adapt to what each one is. I talked more to Jimmy than I ever did to Marlon. I took him aside and finally, when I felt he was disturbed in life by what was happening in his own personal life, I moved him into a dressing room on the Warner Brother lot, and I took the dressing room directly facing it so that I'd always be at hand. I was like a father to him or a big brother to him, and looked after him. Every morning I'd call him out and see what condition he was in, whether he had a miserable night or not. And then I had to several times stop him from owning a horse or a motorbike or whatever, you know. So it became a very different, more intense, more particular relationship. With Marlon, I didn't have to do anything like that.
Let's talk more about acting and your style of directing. Now, you were a member of the group theater in the mid-30s and a co-founder of the Actor Studio. These are the two places where what's been called the method was born. How would you describe the method, and do you think of yourself as subscribing to it?
The method has to do with retreat from artificial emotionalism, where emotion is conveyed by signs and gestures and voice patterns and so forth, but where it's where on the other hand it's actually felt by the actor. He actually feels it, the emotion that he's portraying. It's there in him. And there are techniques which are obvious. They're not so complicated and not so mysterious for arousing emotion by remembering certain things in yourself so that the scene becomes, in a sense, a part of your life.
Mm-hmm. Do you think of yourself as directing with the method, with that method?
I think I do, yes. I think I try to get the real thing out of actors, and I try to stop them from in what we call indicating or gesturing, suggesting a scene by the way they are. In England, they do it differently. The voice is very important there, and the way they have different kinds of plays there. And I don't think that I'm any good to direct Shakespeare or George Bernard Shaw or any play that depends on the way lines are read. I think I'm only good when the somehow or other the play relates to my own experience.
And to the experience of the actor who's playing it.
That's correct. Right, Terry.
Let me quote something you say about Strasberg style. You say that in life people conceal their feelings, but with Strasberg's pupils, they brandished their emotions as if that were the only true measure of talent.
He encouraged that so that whoever would feel, Strasberg, their teacher would feel, and I would feel as the person directing many of them, that they had great intensity and that they were noteworthy for their violence, so that you felt, God, I've got to see that. And, but the plays that we did at that time were also plays of that type. You've just seen two scenes from it, you know?
Yeah.
There were plays where intense emotion rather than coolness and charm and wit and the rest of it were important. I wish the people in the studio had more wit and charm, but you can't have everything in life, and they contributed markedly and importantly to the kind of play that we did.
Is there a danger in that kind of acting where you're really experiencing the emotions of going over the top?
Yes, there is, Terry. That's right.
So how do you draw the line on that? How do you measure?
The director draws the line, Terry. Mm-hmm. The mm-hmm. director says, I've got it. That's enough. Don't go on with it.
So how do you bring someone back down if they're going over the top?
Just look at them.
Tell them less.
They understand right away. They understand. You just say, or you stop the scene and you go back and you do things that will anchor them. In other words, by suggesting certain realistic things. For example, if people start yelling, you say the house next door can hear you. Try to do it so the house next door doesn't hear you. Do you understand?
Yeah. Let me quote something and get your reaction to what you've said. When I hear the term masterclass, I want to vomit.
Well, that's because so much of teaching has become a racket. In other words, so much money is made teaching 40, 50 people how to act. And that's all right. That can be valuable. There are some wonderful teachers. Sanford Meisner was one of Bobby Lewis, a fine teacher. And Stella Adler was a fine teacher. But then there's a whole lot of other people that teach hundreds of people. And it's just one thing that happens is it's a distinction to be in their class or in their, what they call, in their group. And that's when you hear master class. And,
right.
Nobody's a master. Acting is, like all art, a variant. It's a mysterious thing. Sometimes this method is good for the play you're working on. Sometimes it's not. You always have to allow for human variance and ambivalences.
Ilya Kazan is my guest, and he's written an autobiography titled A Life. Now, your autobiography is really the first time you've publicly addressed why you named names during the HUAC hearings
in
the 1950s. And I was wondering why you were ready to talk about it now. For years when you were interviewed, people would ask you about it and you just wouldn't want to talk about it. People have written in their autobiographies how they felt about you naming names, but you've never publicly addressed it till now.
The reason I felt okay about it now was that I always hesitated to do it because I wanted to make it part of my whole life.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, so that everything that happened before had some way or other, not for others, but for me, led up to it. And, for example, I put in the scene where the man from Detroit came and attacked me in front of my group. I put in the scene where we were trying to do a picture in Mexico and the communists there prevented us from doing it for their reasons. I put in other references so that by the time I got to it, you felt I'd been through certain experiences that would at least motivate me, if no one else, into doing that.
Well, my understanding is that you decided to talk for two reasons. One was that you felt that when you were a member of a communist group that the actors are really exploited by the party, and also that you didn't want to give up your career, that you'd really thought about it, and you decided that writers could write while they're in prison, but directors couldn't do anything in prison, and directors couldn't do anything if they were shut out of the industry.
Something like that, but not exactly. I thought, you know, I love my work, and it means everything to me. It's my whole life, really, except my family, and my work. Those are the two things I have. And I thought, why should I give up my career for something I don't believe in? I don't believe in it. And if people who are communists are still are going to attack me and still feel that they don't want to talk about it, I also feel that, then the hell with them, I also feel that any country, for example, England and France, any country has the right to investigate something like was going on in this country. And the only trouble with our committee was that two of the fellows lied to me. They told me that I was in an executive session where I'd be talking privately, and it turned out they were running with the news to Hollywood gossip columnists and everything else, so I lost my respect for them, too.
There are many people who have been in your life who've never forgiven you for naming names and have certainly never forgotten it. Did you expect this decision to stay with you throughout your life in the way that it has?
No, you have to believe me, Terry. I don't give a darn about that.
Uh-huh.
I only am concerned, really, whether I respect myself. I thought a very long time about it. I thought very hard about it, and I did I made a difficult choice. Both sides, both ways would have been difficult for me.
Have you had second thoughts about the choice you made?
Not really, no. I think I wish they'd done it. I wish they'd named me. I think if the whole bunch of us had come out and said, we did have a communist cell, so what? I don't think they would have been worse off. I think it would have been clear the air. But, of course, except for the three I did talk to, they didn't do it.
Ilya Kazan is my guest. I want to get to something you say at the very, very end of your book. You say that when you die, you don't want a big memorial shindig with lots of speeches. You want a big party, but no speeches, and you want everyone that you've ever known invited, including even your enemies, if they're still alive.
Yeah, that's right.
Why do you want that?
Well, because I really am an old-fashioned family-type Mediterranean man. I do like my family enormously. I have a great big family. I have five grandchildren, one more on the way. I have five children. I have stepchildren. I have all kinds of friends that I've had through the years. Not alienated, the opposite. They've become closer and closer. And I just want to say to them, thank you very much for what you've given me in the way of experience and happiness. And here, have a party. And there are all my sweaters and books and things. Help yourself.
You've left money in your will for this party.
Yep.
Why do you want all your enemies to come?
Why not? Then I don't feel about them. I mean, things heal, don't they, after a while? I think so. Anyway, I don't have any bad feeling about anybody. I'm very happy at the moment. I'm very proud of this book. It's called A Life. I'm very proud of it. I think it's a marvelous book, and I think in time, when anybody wants to look back in the 50s and 60s and 70s in American public culture, they will have to read this book, and I think it's a landmark kind of book, so I'm proud I did it. I also did it before I got too old to remember anything, so I'm glad I did that, too.
Okay. I bet you wish you could be around to watch this party when it happens.
I would, yes. I would. I hope there's good liquor there, that's all. I hope nobody gets a hangover.
Well, I want to thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you, Terry. You've been very nice.
Oh, I enjoyed it
very much.
I also
feel you really read the book, which I haven't felt about everybody.
Oh, well, thank you. I enjoyed it very much.
Cool.
My guest has been Ilya Kazan. He's one of the leading theater and film directors of our time, and he's written a new autobiography, which is titled A Life, and it's published by Knopf. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On our next show, I'll be joined by actress Melanie Mayron. She co-stars in the TV series 30-something, and she co-wrote and stars in a new movie called Sticky Fingers. I hope you can join us.
Funding for Fresh Air is provided by a major grant from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and a grant from Fisher's World Travel Guides. Fisher's World Guidebooks, featuring the removable travel planner designed for the intelligent, inquisitive traveler. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY-FM in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. John Rothschild started out with $16,500 and dreams of making a killing in the stock market. He ended up with less than $800 and a book about his experiences called A Fool and His Money. Coming up, John Rothschild tells us what went wrong. Also, rock critic Ken Tucker reviews the debut album from Tracy Chapman, the singer-songwriter Ken describes as a mix of Joan Armatrading, Joni Mitchell, and Suzanne Vega. And film critic Stephen Schiff reviews Babette's Feast, the Danish movie that won this year's Oscar for Best Foreign Film. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news from National Public Radio.
This is Mara Liasson. Police raided two large plants in Poland today in an attempt to end strikes which have paralyzed production. Hundreds of riot police in Gdansk ringed the Lenin shipyard, surrounding Solidarity leader Lech Wałęsa and thousands of strikers who have occupied the plant since Monday. Earlier, police stormed the Nowa Huta steelworks in Krakow under a barrage of percussion grenades. Witnesses say strikers were beaten unconscious by police. Many were then thrown into police vans. In Washington, the White House said it does not believe the political unrest in Poland will create serious problems at the Moscow summit later this month, but spokesman Marlon Fitzwater said it could well be a point for discussion. Three French hostages held in Lebanon for 3 years were flown to France today. They were met by their families and French Prime Minister Jacques Chirac. Details from Lynn Terry in Paris.
The hostages were in weakened states, and soon after they arrived, they were taken to a hospital in Paris to be examined. The hostages, diplomats Marcel Carton and Marcel Fontaine, and journalist Jean-Paul Kaufmann, had been held since 1985 by a pro-Iranian group in Beirut. They said they couldn't believe the ordeal was finally over. They were greeted by several cabinet ministers, including Prime Minister Jacques Chirac. In a short address, Chirac thanked Iran for helping to secure their release. He also said there was a possibility France would now establish relations with Iran. Ties were broken last July over a conflict about terrorism. That announcement has raised questions about a possible deal France made with Iran. However, Chirac firmly denied that was the case, and the Interior Minister said no ransom had been paid. For National Public Radio, this is Lynn Terry in Paris.
The head of the Immigration and Naturalization Service said today that the amnesty program for undocumented workers was a success. INS Commissioner Alan Nelson said more than 1.6 million people requested legalization under the program, which ended at midnight. The INS had originally estimated 2 million would apply. Under the program, undocumented workers who came to the U.S. before January 1, 1982, are eligible for amnesty. A fire and explosion at a Shell oil refinery today in Norco, Louisiana, has left one person dead and six missing. Officials say there is no way to tell whether the six men survived the blast because flames kept firefighters from reaching the area where the explosion occurred. NASA officials said today the explosion and fire at a rocket fuel plant in Henderson, Nevada yesterday will not have an immediate impact on the space shuttle program. The Pacific Engineering Plant is one of only two U.S. producers of ammonium perchlorate, a key ingredient in solid fuel used for space shuttle and military rockets. NPR's Howard Berkus has details.
Spokesmen for NASA and Defense Department contractors say they expect no immediate supply problems. They say enough ammonium perchlorate is stockpiled for the first four shuttle flights scheduled in the next year and for Trident, Midget Man, and MX missiles planned for deployment. There is some uncertainty, though, about future supplies of the chemical. NASA isn't sure that it can quickly substitute ammonium perchlorate supplied by the only remaining processor. There's some question about whether one company's chemical product is interchangeable with the product of another company. Today, space shuttle and ballistic missile officials are trying to assess how much ammonium perchlorate the one remaining plant can produce. The plant's manager says the Defense Department would get priority over NASA in case of a shortage. He says it could take as long as 18 months to increase his own plant's capacity or to build a totally new plant. This is Howard Berkus reporting.
On Wall Street today, the Dow Jones Industrial Average dropped 16 points to close at 2020.23. Declines led advances 7-4 in trading of 172 million shares. The average price of a share lost 17 cents. This is NPR in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Rock critic Ken Tucker has a review of the debut album of Tracy Chapman, an album that has put this 24-year-old singer-songwriter in the spotlight of the folk rock world.
You get a fast car, I want a ticket to anywhere. Maybe we make a deal, maybe together we can get somewhere. Any place is better. Starting from zero, got nothing to lose. Maybe we'll make something. Me, myself, I got nothing to prove.
That's the voice of Tracy Chapman, but if it sounded to you like the voice of Joan Armatrading, you've already hit upon the essential flaw of this widely hailed debut album. In fact, the record has been so extravagantly praised that it was impossible for me, and now you, to come to it with normal expectations. You can't help but think its greatness will jump out at you. But that's not what happens. Instead, you start hearing the influences that inform the music of this 24-year-old singer-songwriter from Cleveland. Joan Armatrading's precise pronunciation, Joni Mitchell's early period folk melodies, Suzanne Vega's meticulous meter and carefully shaped metaphors can all be heard in the songs of Tracy Chapman.
Last night I heard the screaming, loud voices behind the wall. Another sleepless night for me, it won't do no good to call the police. Always come late if they come at all. And when they arrive, they say they can't interfere with domestic affairs between a man and his wife. And as they walk out the door, the tears well up in her eyes.
That's Behind the Wall. It's a slight but well-written song, and if Suzanne Vega hadn't dealt with a similar subject from a similar point of view last year on her song Luca, Chapman's composition might seem more powerful. Part of the problem, in other words, is that when you're dealing with popular culture, the context in which you take in a work of art can be as important as the art itself. In the pop marketplace, the importance of this album is that it's a collection of modern folk songs performed by a black singer-songwriter. At a time when black musicians are stereotyped in the industry as players of funk, jazz, and soul, Tracy Chapman becomes a potent figure, a gesture toward a modest kind of cultural revolution.
Don't you know, we're talking about a revolution, it sounds like a whisper. Don't you know, we're talking about a revolution, it sounds like a whisper. While they're standing in the welfare lines, crying at the doorsteps of those armies of salvation, wasting time in the unemployment lines, sitting around waiting for a promotion. Don't you know, talking about a revolution, it sounds dismal. Who are people gonna rise up and get their share? People gonna rise up and take what's theirs. Don't you know you better run, 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 run. Oh, I said you better run, 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 run. Cause finally the tables are starting to turn. Talking about the revolution.
That's Talking About a Revolution, one of the best songs on this album. Its music courses along urgently, and Chapman's voice is an intriguing combination of warmth and anger. Yet it's also annoyingly vague. This is a call to revolution intended as what? A warning to the well-heeled people who will buy Tracy Chapman's records? She sings, "They're talking about a revolution, it sounds like a whisper," as if we dopes in the audience haven't heard of the discontent many people in the country are feeling these days, or don't feel it ourselves. A little later, she says, poor people gonna rise up and take their share. It's a confusing jumble of rhetoric in which Chapman is keeping herself well distanced from both the audience she's scolding and the poor people she's saluting. A more effective variation on this theme, in part because it's informed by specific details rather than sloganeering, is Mountains of Things.
Life I've always wanted, I guess I'll never have. I'll be working for somebody else until I'm in my grave. I'll be dreaming of a life of ease and mountains, oh, mountains of things. Have a big experience. expensive car, drag my furs on the ground. Have a maid I can tell to bring me anything. Everyone will look at me with envy and with greed. Now revel in their attention and mountains, oh mountains, oh thanks.
It's obvious that Tracy Chapman is a talented musician, and the best way to interpret the raves she's been receiving is to assume that the idea of this music is powerful, that there's a great desire on the part of many people out there to hear music like this, folk melodies with pop instrumentation, and a lyric directness that rarely breaks the surface of rock these days. I just hope that the next time out, Tracy Chapman can make these achievements more compelling.
Ken Tucker writes about popular culture for the Philadelphia Inquirer.
The contradiction, the son who seek the truth. But tell me, why do the babies starve? There's enough food to feed the world. Why wouldn't there so many of us? Are there people still alone? Why are the missiles called peacekeepers when they're aimed to kill? Why is a woman still not safe when she's in her home? Love is hate, war is peace, no is yes. We're all free. But somebody's gonna have to answer. The time is coming soon when the blind remove their blinders and the speeches speak the truth. Tell me, why do the babies starve? There's enough food to feed the world. Why wouldn't there so many of us if there are people still alone? And why are the missiles called peacekeepers when they're aimed to kill? Why is a woman still not safe when she's in her home? Love is hate, war is peace, no is yes, we're all free.
This is Fresh Air. If you go to John Rothschild for investment advice, these are the kinds of tips he'll give you. If you think it's right, then it's wrong, and vice versa. Never invest in anything owned by your broker, and never trust a broker whose suit is worth more than your portfolio. Freelance writer John Rothschild decided to sink what for him was a lot of money into the stock market and write a book about his odyssey as an average investor. I asked him what got him started on this journey.
Well, I decided that there are millions of us out there that have always said if we just had the chance to study this, we could do better than all the experts and hotshots on Wall Street. So I thought, well, this is my chance.
Now, your book is called A Fool and His Money. You didn't expect to play the fool. You thought you'd make a killing?
That's right. It was supposed to be called How I Made a Million on Wall Street and Retired to Bimini. Those are the usual books, but unfortunately, it turned out the other way.
How'd you get the money to invest?
Well, I had some money that I got from the publisher, part of an advance, and then I tried to sell some silverware and so on out of the house, but my wife wouldn't let me. She was very smart. So I ended up selling an old car and an old sailboat and managed to scrape together $16,500. And with that, I was going to make my fortune.
Now, once you got the money scraped together, you read a lot of books about how to invest your money in the stock market. And what you found, I think, was a lot of contradictions.
I did. I read the entire shelf, I think, from one end to the other, which was probably about 200 books. And as I skimmed through them, every time I finished a book, I would say, aha, there's the answer. Don't put all your eggs in one basket. And then, of course, the next book I picked up said, put all your eggs in one basket. The books were no help at all. They put me in the proper confused frame of mind to go out and and seek some human advice. So in that sense, they were, they got me out of the library. And the only thing I would say to people is you don't have to read all these books.
You went shopping for a broker. What was it about that process that reduced you to thinking, should you choose a broker whose clothing matched or clashed with yours?
Well, after sitting there and talking to several brokers and basically hearing them parrot back what they expected me to want, I decided that you might as well choose them on the basis of clothing because you're not going to find out anything more rational to choose them on.
The first buy that you made was something of a disaster.
Right.
Would you describe what you did?
Well, I don't know. I think this is maybe typical average investor behavior. After doing all the research in the books and so on and talking to all the brokers, I walked into the office of a particularly charming broker, having not yet chosen a broker, and I saw two things. One is all the stocks on her Quotron were going up by the second. And the other thing is she got a phone call from somebody very excited about a stock named Angstrom. And I found that almost against my will, it was almost a mystical experience, you know, that I decided that Angstrom was for me and that all of the, you know, all of the signs pointed in this direction. So I jumped up and yelled, I'll take 5,000 shares. And then, of course, I had to carry through with it. So that was my first reasoned, sober investment, was jumping up and saying, Eureka, 5,000 shares of Angstrom.
After all that reading and after all that shopping for a broker, you were so impulsive.
Well, I think people get excited. Not everyone, of course, but I think one thing that happens is we get excited by the hot tip from Uncle Harry next door or what we hear on the bus, and somehow those things seem to carry more weight than the sort of sober, reasoned approach. So I think what I did is I jumped on a stock, as many people are wont to do.
And what happened with the stock?
Well, it went up for a while, and I thought, boy, I'm a genius. All this studying really did help. And then also that I'd picked a wonderful broker and that I was feeling very smart. And then, of course, it started to go down, so that cured all of those feelings.
So did you sell low?
I sold low. I bought high and sold low.
Once you had $16,500 of yours invested in the market, how was your mood and your spending influenced by how your stocks were doing that day?
Well, that was another thing that I wanted to investigate, was sort of the effects of buying stocks on a person in the household. And I found there were a couple of things that happened. One is that my tendency to turn off light bulbs to save electricity sort of increased. With every $1,000 I lost, I would turn off, say, 10 more light bulbs. And I became somewhat of an ogre to my family because, again, for every $1,000 I lost, I would open the refrigerator and say, well, why do we have two broccolis instead of three? Or why don't we buy the cheaper kind of cat food instead of this expensive cat food? And I think there's some kind of rule there of behavior that, you know, that if you've got somebody in your house running around peeking to see how many cat foods there are and what the price on them, chances are they've just lost a lot of money in the stock market.
What were your total profits and losses when the list was tallied at the end of this, what, one-year period?
Yes, I ended up with less than $800, so my total, I was at $16,000, so my loss was, I guess, about 90% or maybe more. Whatever $800 is of $16,500, but of course it could have been worse, I guess.
I
hard
suppose.
To realize, but I, you know, the thing is that, you know, if you've done that badly, I think this book will be your best defense because you can just give it to whoever your critics are and say, well, you know, I didn't do this bad.
Well, the crash of last October came, it's October, right?
Yes, it was October. I've tried to forget, but that was when it was. Actually, I lost most of my money before the crash. But
oh,
anyway.
You did? Oh,
yes,
okay.
I was particularly skillful.
Well, yeah, I mean, a lot of really smart investors lost a lot more than you did after the crash.
Absolutely.
How did that make you feel? It evened out the score in a way.
Well, you know, I didn't feel vindictive to people who were making money. I just it made me feel somehow that that my foolish odyssey was maybe more relevant than it seemed back in August, where, you know, it might have seemed that I was this jerk running around losing money and I was the only one in the country. But my hunch all along was, or at least what I wanted to tell myself, was that other people are in this same boat too, and that my experience will help other people sort of understand or at least appreciate, you know, their own losses. And I think that, you know, after October, that came true.
So do you think that anyone who invests in the market is foolish?
I think that anyone who invests in the market without a sense of what they're doing, without a sort of long-term plan, is foolish. I think people who are whipsawed back and forth by, you know, as I did, trying to find the right advisor and then getting off that and going to the next thing, and especially people who get into options and short-term trading, trying to outsmart the people in New York who do that all the time, are foolish. I think people who have a plan and buy stocks and hold them or whatever the plan happens to be and stick to it probably can do pretty well.
Now, I read that you're actually collaborating on a real investment book with someone.
Well, that's true. This has to be the marriage of the sublime and the ridiculous. The sublime being Peter Lynch, who runs the Fidelity Magellan Fund, and who, over the last 10 years, I discovered, has far outstripped any other mutual fund in terms of the return. And I went to talk to Peter and was delighted to discover that, A, he believed in all of the kinds of pitfalls that I had written about, and also believes that people should not invest in stocks that they know nothing about. In other words, he says if you don't have an edge, if you don't have something in your business or in your life that tells you something about a particular company, you'll never be able to compete with the people out there who do know.
John, you're starting to talk like the author of a serious investment book.
I'm sorry, I'm not the author of a serious investment book, but I'm going to help him tell his story.
Don't you feel like you're playing both sides of the street here?
You know, I would have thought so until I heard what his story was. And in fact, it's very similar to my story. And I think that in a way, I've set out the problem in a humorous way. And I think he has some kinds of, in some way, represents a solution.
Are you still a fool?
I'm still a fool. Now that this has happened to me, I'm trying to think of something else I can write about that where the fool sort of carries on. And I'm sure that in my own life it'll happen, so I won't have to look very far.
One last thing. I take it you're not part of the Rothschild family.
No, they seem to have done very well. I think that if they had hired me as an investment advisor 100 or 50 or even 10 years ago, we wouldn't be hearing much about the Rothschild family.
Well, John Rothschild, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thanks, Terry.
John Rothschild's new book, A Fool and His Money, is published by Viking.
Slipping, dodging, sneaking, peeping, hiding out down the street. See my life shaking with every who I meet. Refried confusion is making itself clear. Wonder which way do I go to get on out of here? Cause I've been in the right place, but it must have been the wrong time. I done said the right thing, but I must have used the wrong line. I took the right road, but I must have took a wrong train. I took the right move.
This is Fresh Air. All Things Considered is coming up with full coverage of today's news. Let's check in with NPR's Daniel Zwerdling and see what they have planned. Hi, Danny. What's coming up?
Hi, Terry. Tough questions tonight about the three Frenchmen, two diplomats and a journalist, who were released yesterday by Lebanese terrorists who'd imprisoned them for almost 3 years. Did the French government negotiate a deal with the terrorists? Some diplomats suspect, yes, they did. The French officials are denying it. And, Terry, you steal 15 tons. What do you get?
Oh, another day older and a deeper in debt.
Actually, this is a bad pun on a serious story. 15 tons of heavy water, which is in big demand because you can use heavy water to help make nuclear weapons. 15 tons of the stuff disappeared somewhere on the way from Norway to West Germany. Who swiped it? Why? The details sound like a spy thriller.
Yipes. Those stories and more coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Babette's Feast is not the kind of movie you want to see on an empty stomach. You'll drool watching a masterpiece of a meal that includes Russian caviar, quail stuffed with foie de gras, baked in puff pastry with truffles, and baba with rum and candied fruit. Film critic Stephen Schiff says you'll walk away satisfied.
It's always been appallingly easy for films to move audiences. Even the worst claptrap can jerk tears if it climaxes in huggy reunions, frisky puppies, or last-minute reprieves. But when a movie deeply stirs spectators by showing food lovingly prepared and eaten, well, then you've either got the mightiest Julia Child show ever broadcast, or you've got Babette's Feast. This is a Danish movie taken from an Isaac Dinesen story and filmed amid the drear of remote Jutland, where the winds are biting and the huts small, and the populace, this being the late 19th century, are reverent Lutherans, hell-bent on the simple life. The little village at the center of the story has long been dominated by the sternly righteous religiosity of its minister, who dies, leaving only his two virginal daughters to carry on his proud tradition. Now those two daughters are elderly, and though they've forsworn all of life's pleasures, their strength is not enough to keep the community together. Its members are growing fractious and ornery. They curse one another between hymns. then into their midst comes Babette, a mysterious Parisian woman on the lam from some unspecified French political strife. Babette needs shelter and is willing to work for nothing for the two sisters. She's played with a seductive air of reserve by the superb French actress Stéphane Audran, and her Gallic briskness and efficiency seem to be just what the community needs. 14 years pass, during which Babette accustoms herself to the community's austerity. She even learns to prepare the brackish gruel that passes for lunch, and to save money on the limp white fish that passes for dinner. In her own way, she's practicing the kind of self-denial that her employers have always practiced, and she, like them, is earning her right to grace, which arrives right on schedule. Babette wins the lottery in her native France, and she asks that before she departs, she be allowed to make a proper French dinner for the community, whereupon the film moves from the merely curious to the sublime. As the meal is prepared and eaten, director Gabriel Axel's style changes from the formal and ascetic to a peculiar, almost antic sensuality. The movie becomes heady and pleasurable, and it also takes on richer undertones. Axel never chooses the easy route of making fun of his stern Lutherans. Instead, he honors their religiosity while demonstrating that what their approach lacks is bliss, the rewards of the senses and of camaraderie, the Dionysian along with the Apollonian. Mixed in with this message is another, that what every artist longs for is the freedom to do his utmost, a message that in this context doesn't sound at all messagey or glib. In fact, Babette's Feast is one of the few message movies I've seen in recent years that actually earns its right to proclaim. It is also that rare movie which actually earns the Oscar, branding it the best foreign film of the last year.
Stephen Schiff is critic-at-large for Vanity Fair and is a contributing correspondent to West 57th. Here's a look at the next Fresh Air. Next time, we'll hear from biologist David Jansen, who's working to preserve and reclaim the world's tropical forests. He sees the threat to the forests as second in significance only to the threat of nuclear war. Also, singer Susanna McCorkle will join us in the first of several tributes to composer Irving Berlin, who celebrates his 100th birthday later this month. And Ken Tucker will take on the video cassette industry for marketing collections of films that aren't worth collecting. So I hope you can join us. We thank everyone who helps make Fresh Air possible.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced.
Our senior producer is Danny Miller. Our producers are Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, and Fred Landerl. Production assistance from Ed Doherty and Alicia Bruton. Our engineer is Ron Barron. Chris Spurgeon directs the show. I'm Terry Gross. Thanks for listening. This is NPR, National Public Radio.